Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Welcome back, Áine Kerr here sitting in for Brendan. Now, David Putnam is a man who has lived many lives, from the film producer who was responsible for The Mission, Midnight Express and the Oscar-winning Chariots of Fire, to his work as an environmentalist and educator. He's the subject of a new documentary, David Putnam, The Long Way Home, which airs on Thursday, June 20th on RTE One. He joins us today to talk about that extraordinary career. David, you're so very welcome to the show.
Thanks, Áine, very much indeed.
Happy Father's Day to you, David. I know you've two kids yourself, and I know this documentary opens, you know, with reflections about your own father. You didn't meet him until you were 5 years old after World War II. Did that kind of delayed introduction to your father have any impact over those formative years?
Enormous. I mean, really enormous impact. I mean, first of all, I only really knew him through photographs and messages, and obviously my mum idolised him. So he was this heroic figure who was somewhere. And then when he came home, it was extraordinary. I mean, the hero of my imagination turned up in my real life. And that was a big moment. And I actually put it into a movie. A third movie I produced was called That'll Be the Day. And what was great was my son played me. So that was nice.
And, you know, there's this phrase, Blitz Baby. What does that mean?
It means that I was in my mother's womb and indeed born right the way through the Blitz. The Blitz started in September 1940, ended in May 1941, and I was born in February 41. So, yeah, the whole of that period of my life, there was bombing every single night in London. I was born and brought up in London.
And living through that war, that sense of danger, the unpredictability, do you think it did teach you some kind of resiliency from a very early age, maybe inoculated you against a sense of danger a little?
Well, it's interesting you've chosen that word, because only recently I've been reading some research about the impact of trauma. This is particularly to do with nowadays in Ukraine, for example, trauma on kids. And it seems to have two effects. Either it can create, you know, a really disturbed sense of insecurity, or you said inoculated, or it can inoculate you against a sense of danger. And I think I was lucky. I think I got the inoculation. I've never really felt fear as such, which is maybe foolish, but it's not something that, you know, I've ever had to really deal with, whereas I know a lot of people spend a lot of their lives dealing in fear.
Your dad was obviously fearless. He was a press photographer, went away to war, came back, went back again, taking photographs. Like him being a photographer, you being in that movie business, do you think that really had a real impact on you? The power of imagery, capturing these moments in time, these history-making moments, had an impact on you from an early age?
I think two things had an impact. One was that the newspapers, you know, we get all the newspapers every day. My dad was in Fleet Street. And there was no such thing as a newspaper. It was either a good edition or a bad edition, or they've used the, you know, Dad would say, you know what, they've used the wrong story in the front page here. This is a better story. So there was a kind of constant at home, a critique of news. And then, of course, the whole issue of photographs, are the photographs well used? Should it have been bigger? Should it have been smaller? So, yeah, I was brought up in that sense with a critique of the way images were used.
How did your relationship evolve? You know, having met him at the age of five, then through the years, he passed away just before your Oscar-winning movie Chariots of Fire came out. What was it like through the years?
I absolutely adored him. I mean, he was the most decent man. I've never met a more decent person in my life. So it was, what I had was something to try and model myself on, or try to. I mean, I never, don't think I ever quite lived up to him, but it wasn't like a trying. He was a huge influence on me.
And what do you think he role modeled in terms of values and principles?
Just that, values, principles. I mentioned in the interview that he used the word fair all the time. My dad could reduce any conversation to fair. And I was reading another piece today in, I think, the Irish Times about the fact that really good people know that if you talk issues through, and if you have a sense of fairness, and you can get rid of a sense of grievance, you will come up with solutions. Unfortunately, we deal in a world of grievance at the moment, and it's very hard to find solutions.
The documentary also reflects The Long Way Home on you meeting your wife, Patsy. You met when you were 15. I think she was just 13. How did she feel about appearing in a documentary of your lives together?
I would say a bit reluctant. What Edel did, the director, did a fantastic job. It's her film. It's her film. Of, I guess, using us as subjects. But she interviewed us separately, so I was pretty nervous as to what Patsy might have said about me. But it seems to be okay.
You're confident, yeah, she hasn't critiqued you unfairly, that it's looking good now all of these years later.
Oh, God, yes. I mean, we've been married, 63 years now? That's a long time.
Wow, amazing. And as you celebrate that longevity of a marriage, you reflect here, I'm sure, on Father's Day, on your dad. Has it been a period of reflection for you when you have to do a documentary like this on your life, your times, the collective body of your work? What's been some of the takeaways for you, David Putnam?
It's an interesting question because the documentary came about because, you know, I teach and it was one of the courses I teach, which in fact I'm starting again this Tuesday, is to a group of filmmakers, some of whom are drawn, four of them drawn from the Northern Ireland's Film Board and some from Screen Ireland. And my happy job is to bring them together for 12 hours and discuss opportunities and the way the film industry is going. So one of my students was a cleaner. Who came back to me after we'd finished the course and said, you know what, during these conversations, I've got really intrigued by your role as a producer. Could I investigate that? And she introduced me to Edel, and the two of them then approached RTE and then came back to me and said, look, RTE would be very interested in doing something. Would you cooperate? Which is exactly how it happened.
You didn't have to be persuaded too much to be the subject this time. You're not the one on the other side of the camera. You're the interviewee for a change.
No, I think for two reasons. Number one, I'm 83, and I thought if I'm going to have an opportunity to say some of this stuff, maybe now's as good a time as any. And the other one was that they picked on something I hadn't really thought about, which is the thread that runs through all my movies, and that actually there is a consistency in them. And that kind of intrigued me. I was very intrigued by the idea that without really realizing it, all my films have a very, very similar theme, or I wouldn't say all of them, most of them have a very similar theme. And they picked up on that, and I thought that was interesting.
What's the theme that binds and bonds all of the movies now?
Male friendship, male relationships, the complexity and the closeness of intense male relationships. And it's in The Memphis Belle, it's in Chariots of Fire, it's in, I could run away through Local Hero to an extent. Killing Fields, very much so. So it's a theme it's a kind of idea that I've ploughed because I felt confident in it. I knew what male friendships were. I knew how important they were. I knew how volatile they could be and how fragile they could be. So I think it's something that obviously fascinated me. Maybe all built around my very, very early relationship with my dad and my sense of needing my father.
Do you think that's something maybe we need to do more of? Like here we are on Father's Day where we celebrate the guardians, the fathers, the uncles, the cousins, the nephews, like the collective male allies who are out there doing their thing, part of our societies, our communities, our families and friendships. Is more of that needed in our drama, our documentaries, our movies, our portrayals?
I think it goes beyond that, Laura. I think it's more of it's needed in our lives. We don't do enough asking each other questions about what we really care about. I mean, with my students, I've always asked and begged them one thing. Get a little camera or use your iPhone. Go home, interview your grandparents. Interview them about their lives. Ask them about their lives. Because in truth, I didn't know anything like enough about my grandparents. I almost know nothing in truth. And I just think we don't understand the lives of the people who fought for us, who for the reasons we're alive at all. We're not very good at it, and we should get better at it.
Where did it start for you? You talked there about sending your students home with the iPhones to do the interviews. How did you find your way into, ultimately, the movies business and telling stories?
I think, I say, partly a journalistic background. When I was growing up, I assumed I'd go into Fleet Street because that's where my dad was, and that didn't happen for all sorts of, I think, good reasons, really. Then I went to advertising, and when at the age of 26, 27, I was, and bear in mind, this was the 60s. It was a very different kind of environment. I thought, well, what do I really want to do with the rest of my life? Well, the answer was either music or movies. They were the two things I loved. And I'm glad to say, I chose the movies.
And you credit over the years, obviously 1960s London, a huge experience for you, but you credit the Beatles as being a critical factor in you breaking through in your career. Why?
Well, they did. They cracked the glass ceiling. It wasn't more the glass ceiling, it was a concrete ceiling. I mean, Britain was an extremely structured, quite grey society in 61, 62. And Beatles came along 63, 64 and changed all that. I mean, all of a sudden, things opened up for my generation. I'm exactly their age. For my generation, that just weren't there in the past. And it was instilled an enormous amount of confidence. One of the reasons I bang on a bit here in Ireland as an Irishman is so much of a nation's success is built around its confidence, its vision, its belief in itself. And we sometimes falter in that respect. This is a great country and with enormous potential. And the only thing sometimes lacking is self-belief.
You referred to yourself there as an Irishman and you became an Irish citizen in 2021. You went through the process of getting Irish citizenship. What was that like?
Well, it was actually rather wonderful. I mean, we've had a home here since 1990, so I've been here a lot. And I was commuting for a good number of those years back and forth to Westminster. No, it was wonderful. It was due to happen the week that COVID broke out. That's what's really weird. So the whole thing's put on hold for 2 years almost. But the actual ceremony was extraordinarily moving in Killarney. And it was like an enormous sigh of relief for me because I was, you know, I've been so damaged and upset by Brexit and what I saw happening in the UK. You know, watching your country of birth kind of go into a state of paralysis is not a comfortable thing. It was awful. So becoming a citizen of a country that I have total belief in, and which I'm, in a sense, proud of in a way that I was never able to be proud of England, particularly, and I specify England, was a relief, yeah.
And in moving to Skibbereen in Cork and going through, you're an Irish citizen, have the Corkonians accepted you down there now? They don't cast you as a blow-in anymore, I hope.
Well, I don't know. I mean, about 20 years ago, Patsy and I actually became Cork People of the Year. I don't know what we did to deserve that. It was a lovely event. I love this. I love my town. I love West Cork. I think it's the most beautiful place on earth. And I have travelled all around the world, so I can say that with some confidence. And I'm very comfortable here. And there's a middle classness to me, which I value and which I feel is reciprocated here. People don't expect you to have any airs and graces. I like to think I've never had any airs and graces, so I feel very comfortable.
Do you think there is a different perception of class in the UK compared to Ireland?
Unquestionably. I mean, class, the layering of class in the UK is very complicated and very real. I mean, no one should ever underestimate it. The moment you open your mouth in the UK, people will identify where you are, not just regionally, but on a class structure. I can go into a pub here in West Cork. I have no idea who within that pub has got money, hasn't got money, and I don't think they could give a shit either way. I think it's about who you are, what you do for the community, and what you see as your role in the lives of your neighbours and your and colleagues.
The decision to leave the UK, to base yourself in Skibbereen, you retired your lordship. As you reflect back on Brexit and those big decisions, those big moments, are you happy you called it right? Like, did it feel knee-jerk in the moment or?
No, I knew I was right, and I was sort of stunned and appalled that what was entirely obvious to me and obvious to people even a lot smarter than me, that was going on. It was like watching a country go into a sort of a spasm of self-destruction. It'll be a generation before the UK recovers from Brexit. And it was unnecessary and utterly tragic.
You called it, I think, in your speech at the time, you labelled it pig ignorance.
Yes.
What was it that was fueling? Like it felt angry at the time, maybe less so now, but yeah, what was the driving emotion at the time?
I was very angry. We were being lied to. I mean, I can now say that. I'm not in the chamber of the House of Lords. I can use the word. We were being lied to, and a very, very interesting country is being hopelessly misled. I was at the opening ceremony of the 2012 Olympics. I've never been more proud of the environment in which we were and what had been achieved. It was amazing. And the fact that within 4 or 5 years, the country could do this to itself was so shocking to me. It's actually quite hard for me to talk about Orla because it is that upsetting.
What do you think happened, though, between a 2012 Olympics that unified a lot of people and, you know, shared identity, shared positivity, to then this moment of Brexit? What happened in those intervening years?
An entire country got misled. An entire country went like sheep in a direction that was being led in, you know. But there was no question. But Gove and Johnson, the rest of them, they knew exactly what they were doing. And what they were doing was using triggers of fear, the immigration as a trigger, decline as a notional decline as a trigger. These triggers are very real. One of the reasons I speak out as often as I can about immigration and racism here in Ireland is people don't understand how dangerous that sort of rhetoric is. It's lethal, and it only has one end to it, and the end is disaster. Absolute disaster. The right, you know, in your news broadcast just now, you're talking about the right. Well, the right and indeed the extreme left are very, very dangerous groups of people. What Ireland's managed to do in the last 20, 30, 40 years is find itself in a centre which may at times seem a bit boring, but it's balanced, it's rational. It doesn't involve hanging people, flogging people. It's tended to veer towards finding the truth in situations. And that's beyond price. And I as a very old man now, I know enough about this stuff. I've seen the results of neo-fascism, and every bone of my body is dedicated to preventing it happening in Ireland.
Given those triggers that you've seen play out in the UK and your dedication to better understanding misinformation, disinformation, things like hate speech, do you see, while you're seeing the centre holds in Ireland, do you see some of the triggers playing out in Ireland that you've seen in other countries that maybe history also teaches us about?
I do. What I see is the simplification of language, the othering of people who are not, as it were, like us. You know, there's a very interesting little story this week. I'm an athletics fan, needless to say. And watching Rashidat win get a silver medal in the European Games and then be part of that 400 meter thing was utterly inspiring, and I'm sure inspired a lot of kids. But then to discover yesterday in the paper that there were 22,000 tweets saying that she wasn't Irish, and it was a disgrace that she was preventing true Irish people, that's the phrase, true Irish people from running for Ireland. Now that kind of nonsense. And that it's actually beyond stupidity, and I'm sure 99.9% of people listening to this program would agree. But once ideas like that catch hold, they're very dangerous, and you have to literally stop them, you know, at birth.
So how do you stop? Because I know you pay very close attention to concepts like artificial intelligence and, you know, content moderation, and how you even get ahead sometimes of just real world harms, hateful speech, right down to then things like education, news literacy and everything in between. How do you stop what you're describing?
Well, the very last report I did for the government, the House of Lords report, which I chaired, was about trust, creating trust in a digital environment. You know, you'll be more familiar than I am with the dangers of this. And what you need to do is actually have, from day one, in terms of young people's education, get them to understand what trusted sources are, what's real, what are actually the net results of neo-fascism and extreme right-wing politics. Understand how the Nazi Party evolved in Germany. Understand why it evolved. Understand the fears that were able to be inflamed and addressed. So we need to understand all that. We need a generation of young people who are so savvy and so understanding of what the dangers to society are that they reject them at birth.
When you look across to the UK and you see an election happening there and you see all of the forecasts around the Tories, now Nigel Farage back in, the Labour Party, how do you think those parts of it playing out? Do you think there is a readiness for just, you know, a fact-based election. How do you think that election will play out?
There isn't, and that's one of the things that most distresses me. So in the report I just referred to, we advocated or recommended the need for digital, you know, for regulation regarding digital political advertising, so that political advertising has to contain a source. You need to know what party it's in favour of and how truthful or accurate it is. That was rejected by the Tory government. They weren't interested in accurate political advertising. What they wanted was advantageous advertising. Now, that is a beginning of another different type of slippery slope.
And so you could see the Labour Party in government, if the polls are correct. Would you have an expectation that some of this will get renewed attention?
I'd hope so. I mean, my own view is I'm not interested particularly in party labels in Ireland or in the UK. I'm interested in people. I'm interested in integrity of people, what their values are, what their competence is, and most of all, what their vision for their country is. I will hold the incoming Labour government, I'm sure it will be, to exactly the same standards that I try to hold the Tories to.
And you mentioned there that you care about people, and you really do think a lot about working class people in how you go about your business, and trying to create now opportunities for them to get into industries like yours in entertainment, movies. How are you playing your part there, David Putnam?
Well, we did a pilot year before last that was very successful, actually, with TY students, introducing them to the broad sense of the media world, you know, the world you're in, the world I've been in, and seeing it as a natural part of the job opportunities available to them. So what I try to do is open up as much as I can the idea that people can do anything. Look, Ola, the idea that I, as a kid in North London, going to the cinema twice a week, was ever going to end up in Hollywood producing movies was insane, really, when you think about it. It was crazy. And yet it opened up for me. I want to see those sort of opportunities open up for people, or at least have young people believe that if they put their shoulders to the wheel, they really, really try, that any kind of life is possible for them. I don't like the idea that lives get closed down age 14 because you're not good at maths or because you haven't passed this exam or that exam. My experience of life, it's not like that. It's that I'm an optimist in that sense. I think that life can be utterly remarkable. But I'm also aware of the fact that this generation of young people are emerging into a more dangerous and more difficult world than even I did in World War II. And so I'm very conscious of that as well.
And so what's that role that you play today? Do you want to be someone who's opening doors for them, giving them tools, skills, and just hopefully get them on the runway that they're set up for success?
Yeah, I mean, what I try to do, and I teach a lot all the time, but I'm teaching basically filmmakers. What I try and teach the filmmakers I work with is the enormous responsibility that comes with that job. I mean, without putting you on the spot, I think the job you do carries enormous responsibility. You know very well that when you're on air and you're saying things, people don't just believe you, they want to believe you. Therefore, your obligation, RTE's obligation, is to be factual and accurate and fair. And that's why I'm a passionate believer in public service broadcasting. I mean, I really am. I go to the firing squad in favour of public service broadcasting. It's vital.
Because what you're talking about there is trust and transparency, and yes, those are values and principles that I'm sure you're trying to teach young people all of the time. Do you also, as much as you're trying to get them into the movie business and the entertainment industry, would you encourage young people today into the world of journalism that you
very,
love?
Very, very much so. Very much so. I'm very lucky. I'm the life president of the National Film Television School in the UK. And I did the graduation ceremony in February. And that was my entire speech, a really short speech, actually, about that, was the responsibility that comes with filmmakers and that comes with journalists, and how important it is that we get the very best of our young people, not only into our professions, and I do think they're professions, but that to take the responsibilities that come with that profession hugely seriously. Now we're the advocates. We're the people that basically advise people on what's best for them, what's best for their lives.
What could make it hard, of course, for the young people that you work with today is the emergence of artificial intelligence, and just we know how much money is being invested in that, and you know, there are a lot of fears about job displacement, and you know, people kind of come between, should you fear it? Is it going to be helpful? or could it be a hindrance? Where do you break out now in that argument about this emergence of AI and how it can impact the future jobs of those young people?
Well, we start with the fact that it's here. We're living with it in exactly the same way we live with motor cars. It's a reality. So the real issue is, what do you do about regulating its use and being conscious of the downside? So just as over a number of years, we learned how to regulate cars, licensed drivers, we don't let anyone drive a car, we've got to be similarly cautious. But the real lesson here for us, which is a useful one, we've seen the upside and the downside of social media, haven't we? All of us are very conscious of what's been wrong in terms of the development of social media and also the huge advantages that have come. If we don't take the lessons we've learned from social media and apply them to AI, then we're really dumb. And I don't think we are dumb. So we've got a wonderful living example of the last 10, 15 years of social media to refer to and reflect upon and apply to AI.
Do you think our Leaving Cert, how we teach kids in our second level schools, in our universities, therefore has to change to prepare them for that world?
I think quite dramatically. I mean, I've been a critic, I'm afraid, of the Leaving Cert ever since I've been living in Ireland. I think it's a very, very blunt instrument, and I'm not sure it provides either the kids or society at large here with the young people we're going to need in the next 20, 30, 40 years. They're going to need to be a different type of human being almost, with a different set of skills and a different attitude to the place of work and their roles within society. I don't think the Leaving Cert does any of that. I very much like the opportunity that TY offers, and I think if we were able to fund TY properly and apply it well, I think it could be an enormous help. But I think the net result of that would be a rethinking of the Leaving Cert.
What would you like to see, though, when you talk there about different skills, maybe even different mindsets? Have you any kind of practical ideas you're passionate on?
Yeah, I mean, they've all been very well rehearsed, in truth, and I don't want to sound like a crack record, but it's learning how to work as teams, it's being flexible, it's understanding you're not going to get a job for life, that you're going to have to constantly learn and relearn. You know, I was very lucky. I went to night school when it was a very affordable thing to do, and I learned a whole slew of possible ways in which I could exercise my very limited skills. So I think the you know, that awful overused phrase, a lifelong learner, every single person's going to have to become a lifelong learner, because the nature of what they do and the technology with which they do it is going to alter 3-4 times during their careers.
Is that the secret to your extraordinary success through the years, is that you've stayed curious, you've constantly evolved, just always been learning?
Yeah, I think it is. I heard myself say the other day, you know, every now and then you say something, you say, oh God, yeah, I really feel that. But what have I spent my life doing? I've been questioning orthodoxy all my life, how legitimate any particular piece of orthodoxy is. But the great thing about doing that is you come out with things like, my God, I didn't realize how important public service broadcasting was until it became under threat. So that's an example. Another example was, why are we doing that? Because it's not very effective. We need to find another way of doing it. So I think you're quite right. I think what I've always done is question the status quo, what the orthodoxy is, and how things can be improved. That's just the way I am.
Wise words, learn and relearn and stay curious. David Putnam, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Anya, very much for listening to me.
The documentary David Putnam, The Long Road Home, airs on RTÉ One Television on Thursday, June 20th at 10:15 p.m. We'll be back after these.
Email brendan@rte.ie.